our second speaker for this afternoon is Lloyd Martins, and he will tell us about dark energy and modified gravity.
Thanks very much, and thanks for the invitation. My first trip to America. Very impressive, State College. Very nice to be here. My first trip to America. Well, to the USA. To the USA. Now, unfortunately, where it says ICG workshop, Penn State, May 2008, got cut off, and where it said here, Robert Caldwell, who's responsible for this rather nice design, is also cut off. But I think the following slides don't have anything cut off them. I hope so, anyway. Right, I can, after the excellent talks this morning and this afternoon by Licha and Mark, I can jump straight into the topic. I'm not going to go straight into modified gravity because I just want to set a few parameters, set the framework. And of course, we all start off in one way or another admiring how well the standard model Lambda CDM fits this wealth of data. And I've shown the premier data sets here, the cleanest probe, the CMB and WMAP, and the galaxy distribution as shown by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the premier survey, the current best we have. And here is that baryon acoustic oscillation peak shown as Licha had it this morning, and the WMAP, this is probably WMAP3, and the same red curve with the same parameters fits both of the sets of data very well. And when you add in the supernovae, you find a third independent set of data. The three things intersect in the same place, which, of course, is not guaranteed to have happened. And they intersect in a place serendipitously, which is consistent with inflation. Omega K is nearly zero. And we have this remarkably successful standard model, which manages to pass all of these various tests. We can add into this weak lensing and some of the other things that were discussed in other talks. Again, Lambda CDM passes all the tests. But everybody has to remark just how unsatisfactory this is when you look at the cosmic energy budget in one form or another. I've forgotten who this is due to, so I don't have the proper acknowledgement here, but thanks to whoever it was, it's a nice cartoon. And we find that 96% of the universe's contents are dark and unknown. The cold dark matter crisis, in inverted commas, is less of a problem because particle physics has a number of reasonable-looking candidates for the cold dark matter, and we have reasons to understand why it's been so difficult to detect these particles by non-gravitational experiments. But the dark energy, which is the major part of the dark puzzle, as has been explained already, presents much more of a challenge. And of course, what I'm going to focus on today is it really dark energy, or could it be a change in gravity itself, the theory of gravity? So this slide, I must apologize in advance to Abe before I go through it. And please don't associate the argument too closely with me. It's not due to me, and I don't take any responsibility for it. But if we try to understand how, in the standard majority view, this is a crisis for particle physics, it goes something like the following. This Lambda CDM model, which is so successful as a parameter framework for understanding the universe, and which, by the way, is better at that than any other model that we know of, because although you can improve the fit by adding new parameters using more complicated models, if you take some basic statistical tests which penalize the number of parameters, you don't really ever get a better fit than you do with Lambda CDM. But why is it a theoretical crisis? Well, if we look at the observed value in the vacuum energy, that's a geometric mean, essentially, of the Hubble rate today and the Planck mass. This just comes from the G, and lambda goes like H naught squared from the Friedmann equation, because dark energy is dominant today. So we have these incredibly widely separated energy scales, 10 to the minus 33 electron volts for the current Hubble rate, and 10 to the 28 electron volts for the Planck mass, and they give us this absurdly small energy scale, 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. But if we look at the standard way of interpreting vacuum energy, if we apply the idea that the vacuum energy due to all fields, all quantum fields, is estimated by the cutoff scale to the power 4. This is the energy scale where new physics comes in to give us a ultraviolet completion of our theory, a quantum gravity theory. Then the lowest we can really have this energy scale of new physics would be a TeV, because if it went lower than a TeV, we would have seen it already in the colliders. And if supersymmetry is part of the fabric of nature, then supersymmetry has this marvelous cancellation between fermion and boson fields, and so we'd expect that the vacuum energy should be at least at the supersymmetry breaking scale, which has to be bigger than or equal to 1 TeV. So that's the smallest we can get this within that standard approach to the vacuum energy, and this is enormously much bigger than the observed value. So why is it so small? And in addition to that, and even if we can get around that, we have this other problem, the so-called coincidence fine-tuning problem, and that is simply the statement that why is the energy density in the vacuum of the same order of magnitude as the current energy density in matter? This is crucial for structure formation. If we violate this by an order of magnitude, then the universe could not look anything like the way we observe it today. And the key thing, of course, is that rho lambda is a constant while the matter density is redshifting like 8 to the minus 3. So we have this coincidence problem to explain why we have this fine-tuning that the white curve crosses the yellow curve late enough for structure formation to have set in the universe. And of course, the modified gravity alternatives I'll talk about essentially are addressing, in one way or another, the coincidence problem, not the vacuum energy problem. But before I go to the problem of coincidence, let me just say a few things about the vacuum energy. Now, again, I know very little about string theory and very little about any other alternative quantum gravity candidates, so I'm just giving the qualitative hand-waving version of what I understand. What can string theory tell us about the vacuum energy? Any string theorists in the audience, I'll rely on you to answer any questions here. So, as far as I know, the ideas which have emerged which may address this problem are loosely collected under the phrase the string landscape, which is the landscape of a huge number of vacuum energy states predicted by string theory because there are so many fields. And so if you have a sort of a picture like this in which each different vacuum state has its vacuum energy, we have a range of vacuum energy from negative to huge, and then our universe just happens to be that patch of this, what we could call a multiverse. We just happen to be living in a patch of the multiverse in which the vacuum energy in this vast spectrum of possibilities happens to be 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. And then the question becomes, how do we actually understand the probability distribution for vacuum energy states in the multiverse? But of course, I have to emphasize that this is very speculative and controversial, even amongst string theorists. But nevertheless, that's one of the ideas which has been put forward to tackle this problem. Another approach within string theory is to look at this problem from the point of view of essentially of the space-time topology. These are the so-called self-tuning brain world models. And the basic idea here is that the higher dimensional space-time itself has a vacuum energy which is, as you might expect it, is of the order of the fundamental scale to the power 4 plus n, where n is the number of extra dimensions. But our four-dimensional universe is protected from this higher vacuum energy by what's known as a self-tuning mechanism. And the models typically look something like this. You have a higher dimensional model which has the n extra dimensions compactified something like in the form of a sphere. And if you put a cut through the sphere and join the ends together, you get two conical singularities, at one of which is located our four-dimensional brain universe. And no matter what the size of the vacuum energy is in the full 4 plus n dimensional space-time, the 4D brain universe is actually protected from that vacuum energy. But unfortunately, these models are unstable, so they may lead towards a solution, but currently that doesn't work. Of course, there are other quantum gravity approaches, other approaches to quantum gravity, and each of them would have something different to say about the vacuum energy. I'm not sure what the answer is. So loop quantum gravity, I'm sure Abe and Martin will answer any questions about what that has to say about the vacuum energy. Then there's causal sets and there's some other theories. And I don't really know what the specific they may have to say about the vacuum energy. Clearly, this is an area of particle physics which is of extremely high importance, and people are working on this problem, and in a sense, cosmologists, if they're sensible, would hope for a rapid resolution so that we could stop running after all these crazy models that we've been chasing in the last 10 years. It's getting quite tiresome. So hopefully the particle physicists will actually finally come up with a satisfactory solution, but I wouldn't hold my breath on that one. So we could take, in that same vein, a sort of a minimalist attitude, which is like a practical working cosmologist attitude to the problem, and that is just to say, look, LCDM is the best we've got. It's the simplest model. Occam's razor tells us, let's be happy with it, and let's focus our attention on the best way of testing it against the data, how to test it, whether lambda is constant or W is minus one or not. And meanwhile, we'll let the particle physicists and the quantum gravity theorists sort out the problem of the vacuum energy, why it is of the scale 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. And there are lots of interesting things that we could and should be focusing on. In particular, as we've already discussed in previous talks, the issue of what are the best tests for whether or not W is minus 1 or a constant. One would like to look a little bit more clearly at the role of theoretical assumptions as well as priors, which have been rubbed off here, but we're not forgetting them. Theoretical assumptions such as assuming that W is constant, whether or not it's minus 1, that forces all sorts of degeneracies. Assuming that the curvature is zero, and if we believe that the back reaction of structure formation might induce small corrections to the effective background curvature, then this in particular may be a very dangerous assumption. So that's a new area of worry for cosmology. And also what was mentioned, I think, by Alicia, the sensitivity of the data to specific parametrizations of W when it's not constant. But of course, the real answer to this is that there are enough cosmologists who are doing this, so there's too many cosmologists around and the rest of us have to do something else. So we have to justify it as well. Well, a justification is that we can actually do a lot more with the data. And this really is also quite true. This exquisite data, which is personified really by the CMB and WMAP, allows us to do a lot more than that. We can actually go further and we can test alternatives as well as testing lambda CDM. So what are these alternatives? Well, first of all, there are the alternatives within general relativity, which have been discussed more extensively by Leitcher and by Mark, and then those outside of general relativity, which Mark has discussed to some extent, and I'll discuss a bit further. I'll say something, first of all, about the GR options before I move on to the modified gravity. So I've identified two types of model here. The dynamical dark energy in the form of some field, quintessence, is the canonical one. Coupled dark energy, which is also dealt with by Mark and various other possibilities. And then a radically different proposal that dark energy is just a mirage effect which follows from the nonlinear effects of structure formation. I'll say a few things about that. But most of that, the more important discussion of the second option will come tomorrow from Tirta's talk. Under the modified gravity heading, there are basically two types of modified theories that I'll briefly discuss. I'm not trying to do anything exhaustive here because there really are a lot of theories out there, and I don't even know how to classify all of them, but a lot of them do fall into one of these two categories. Roughly speaking, four-dimensional models, which may or may not be motivated by string theory, but they are, we can deal with them as four-dimensional models, and they're essentially scalar tensor models, or actually scalar vector tensor models in the most general form. And the simplest avatar here is F of R models, which Mark has already introduced, and I'll use as an example as I go along. Or the higher dimensional, the genuinely higher dimensional models, which are brain world models, and the simplest example here, is the DGP model, which I will also use as an example. So the first thing we can say is that these alternatives all require that the vacuum energy is exactly zero. They don't address this problem of why the vacuum energy is small. They actually say, well, the vacuum energy is zero, and the dynamical field that we're talking about, or the modification of gravity that we're talking about, will account for this low energy scale acceleration. So they really are addressing the coincidence problem and evading the vacuum energy problem. And if Abay and others find a simpler solution to the vacuum energy problem, then you know that would fit in with this approach, that dynamical dark energy is the way to go. So dark energy dynamics just puts an extra term on the right-hand side, the matter side, which has an effective equation of state less than minus a third and happens to be time-varying in the background. The modified gravity dynamics modifies the left-hand side, the geometric side of the field equations, if you like, schematically by some correction to the Einstein tensor. And this introduces a new scalar degree of freedom and maybe extra, more than one scalar degree of freedom, vector degrees of freedom, perhaps some massive spin 2 degrees of freedom as well. And these, at least one of these, has to be invoked in order to induce low energy scale or infrared corrections to give acceleration. So this picture here of the locomotive, those of you who have heard me talk before or have seen this before, my apologies to you. But I like that someone painted Einstein's equations on an old locomotive somewhere, and I can't remember where it is. But this just conveys the idea that Einstein's theory runs out of steam on large enough scales and it has to be subsumed by some other theory which reduces to Einstein's theory on smaller scales. It could be. In my mind, it's either India or Peru. I'm not sure why those two will be in there. Yeah. So quintessence, Mark went through quintessence. Let me just whiz through it even faster. The sets of models which are of most importance are the so-called tracker quintessence models. So in the early universe, the scalar field tracks radiation, which is dominant. Then it starts to track matter when matter becomes dominant. And then it suddenly turns the corner and takes over dominating the energy content of the universe and accelerating the universe. And so you can actually do models like this which are insensitive to the initial conditions, but unfortunately you have to apply extreme fine-tuning to the parameters and the potential that ensure that this transition takes place at the right time. So essentially you don't really solve the coincidence problem. So what about more complicated dynamical models? I would claim, but I don't want to push this too hard in case there's some champions here of these models, I would claim that most of these are quite poorly motivated because they introduce more complication, but they don't actually solve the problem. And some of them are actually either ruled out or made rather unpleasant by theoretical problems. So Mark was talking about phantom scalar fields. These are fields with negative kinetic energy density, so they have this unstable vacuum. They have a ghost state, so we should just throw away all phantom scalar fields unless we really desperately in need of another publication or two about a weird model, but essentially one should really rule those out. K-essence models, if they accelerate the late universe, they violate causality. In other words, the speed of sound exceeds one, and for old-fashioned people like me, that means the end of the theory, but if you're more adventurous, you might want to hang on to it, and I would say we'd throw it out. The Chaplin gas, well, just what phenomenology motivates that? Absolutely none that I know of, but I'd throw them out too, but I might be being a bit too harsh. I think, though, that for theorists, we should be in the business of getting rid of models, not creating new ones, as far as we can. Its speed of sound is greater than one. Yes, I know. I've had a sort of indirect debate with them, myself and Malcolm and McCullum and George Ellis about this. I mean, it's partly a subjective thing as to whether you think that you can accept the violation. We can go into a discussion maybe. Come back to that point if you like. What I think are more interesting are the coupled quintessence models which Mark referred to. And the reason I find them more interesting, they are different from ordinary quintessence in the sense that if you think a bit about dark matter and dark energy, you realize that both of them are only detected gravitationally. So we only really know the sum of the two, the energy momentum tensor representing the sum of the two. And we know it from their gravitational effects alone. And in a sense, we have to impose a theoretical prior in order to separate the two. So this does, there's an unavoidable degeneracy there. And it does open up the possibility that there could be a coupling in the dark sector between these two forms of dark energy and dark matter. Since both of them are outside of the standard model of physics, we could protect this coupling from the kinds of restraints that would exist on standard model fields by saying that the coupling is purely between dark matter and dark energy, doesn't include baryons and radiation. And so just at a general level, the divergence of the energy momentum tensor of the scalar field and of cold dark matter is non-zero, but of course equal to minus each other to preserve overall energy momentum conservation. And in the background, you'd have an exchange of energy between the two. By the way, the coupling to standard model fields is strongly constrained by local gravity tests. So this coupling Q in the dark sector would be far less constrained, far more weakly constrained. It's only constrained by cosmological gravitational tests. Now, the instabilities that Mark focused on, I won't mention them, but there are, so for those models which don't suffer from things like instabilities, there's, of course, an intrinsic bias in the CDM relative to the baryons because the CDM is being dragged by the dark energy due to this coupling. And so, in fact, the Euler equation for cold dark matter is violated, and I'll come back to this later. This allows us to distinguish these models from modified gravity. There are also other interesting features. Mark already mentioned the W less than minus 1 without ghosts being one of the features. And for example, there could be very strong signals in weak lensing and the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect on these models and cluster counts. Now, very briefly, a few words about the idea that dark energy is really an effective field that arises from nonlinear effects emerging in structure formation. More of this will come in the talk tomorrow, so I won't say too much. This is a much more radical approach to the coincidence problem, and it would be a very satisfactory resolution because it wouldn't invoke any new exotic fields, and it would be based on standard low-energy gravity physics that we know and love in Einstein's theory if it worked. And there is a very peculiar feature. Well, I find it peculiar. If you look at the evolution of large-scale structure, here's a simulation. It's probably way out of date now, but it gives the basic idea from the linear regime to the nonlinear with the voids and the filaments. It's well known that the nonlinear regime, i.e. where the overdensity starts to exceed 1, typically happens on scales less than of the order of 10 H inverse megaparsecs. But we also notice that the scale of the voids that we see and the filaments that we see can be on scales of an order of a magnitude larger than that. So there is something that is yet to be understood as to how we jump up an order of magnitude here. And it does beg the question as to whether we can actually start having cosmological effects, because these scales are too small to account for acceleration. These scales are starting to look like the kinds of scales that you need to affect in a back reaction way if you want to hope to affect the background evolution of the universe so as to get acceleration. Now, this is a very difficult problem because it's asking the question, how do you average over a given inhomogeneous background to fit the correct, inhomogeneous universe, how do you average over that to fit the correct background? And the idea is that as structure grows, the background that is correctly fitting your averaged universe is changing with time. But nobody really knows how to do the nonlinear averaging. There are various prescriptions that have been put forward. They look more or less convincing. Some of them predict corrections. Some people have extracted from those predictions the possibility that the moving background that you have as the averaging process proceeds can accelerate the universe, but I think the majority view is that the effect is not big enough to accelerate the universe. However, the effect seems to be real and may be big enough to make important corrections to the way in which we interpret observations. So there is that important byproduct from this question posed by the acceleration of the universe. Even if this doesn't lead to a solution, it may lead to other important consequences for cosmology. That's a point I'll come back to later in general.
Best scenario, does it explain about 10% of the effect, or completely negligible?
Well, it depends which papers you look at. And also, partly, to be fair to people, it depends on what assumptions they put in to try and model the averaging and the back reaction. So the original papers claimed that you could get everything you wanted, and then they were hotly disputed. And then there's been a series of papers which carry on today with still two camps, some saying yes you can and others saying no you can't.
There's also the fact that they'll say you
Well, I'm not saying.
Yet.
I'm not. Well, there are two issues here. This is a way of doing away with lambda. The attempt is to do away with lambda, so you just have a low density universe with ordinary matter, and you hope that the nonlinear effects will actually lead to an effective acceleration of the universe.
So I'm saying that the
majority consensus seems to be that that won't work. The correction required is too large. Then I'm saying that although it's a small correction,
I would think the data would lose out. As far as I know, it hasn't been studied.
Well, to some extent, there's no.
Yeah.
Well, it.
Okay, so for I should have said lambda CDM. But start with simulations, you make predictions, and I bet you with this kind of stuff.
Well, it. So you're saying that if the correction's big enough to accelerate the universe, then it might mess up other observations. Well, people have done some hand waving sort of. This is not going to affect the CMB because that's way back in the linear regime. So the CMB is safe. The integrated Sachs-Wolf is going to be affected, but the observations are so poorly constrained. Well, it could be that there. I don't think people have looked at that enough because I don't think enough people take the large correction option seriously. But the small correction option seems more realistic. Just how small, you're right, would be constrained by observations. But it's not a question of explaining the observations. That's a question. The small corrections would just make small corrections to how we interpret the observations. So if we're interpreting the universe as having omega k is zero and omega k is actually slowly growing, or the modulus of omega k is slowly growing in this scenario, then that will induce a small correction to the way in which we interpret observations. Okay. So this would have been a nice idea, but it doesn't seem to work. The basic point, by the way, just from a physical point of view, a void is like adding some negative mass matter to the original average Robertson-Walker you started off with in the linear regime. So you can see that it's going to expand faster. And since voids are known to dominate over filaments, they occupy much more space than the filaments. On average, you're going to have some kind of effect of increasing the rate of expansion. But to get it enough to make it accelerate, that's the problem. The more radical alternative yet, and this is, I think, what Tirta is going to talk about, is to abandon the Copernican principle and to say that we're actually sitting at or near the center of a large void of a scale of this kind of order of magnitude, and to try to explain the apparent acceleration from that viewpoint. So I'll leave tomorrow's talk for the details on that one. And that may or may not be viable. But that would be more radical, not only because it throws away dark energy, but also it throws away the Copernican principle, which is the foundation stone, or one of the foundation stones of the standard model of cosmology. We can discuss that more later if you like. So now finally I get to the main point of what I wanted to talk about today, which is the alternative which says that perhaps Einstein's theory itself is wrong on large scales. So in GR, the acceleration comes because of the anti-gravity effect of a dark energy field. W is less than minus a third. That's what I mean loosely by the anti-gravity effect. Or, of course, perhaps via nonlinear effects, but this seems to be much more difficult to achieve. The modified gravity alternative would say that the acceleration comes from the weakening of gravity on the largest scales. So that's the basic idea. And this idea, again, Mark has already referred to the planet Vulcan, which was postulated to explain the anomalous precession of the perihelion of Mercury. And it turned out that this could not be explained by some dark planet that required a change in gravity itself. So perhaps we're at that kind of point today in cosmology. But we first have to realize something which has already begun to emerge from the conclusions of some of Mark's examples. It's extremely hard to theoretically consistently, to modify GR in the infrared without invoking ghosts, instabilities, all sorts of unpleasantness. And if you do succeed to consistently modify GR in the infrared from a theoretical point of view, it is then extremely difficult for you to match not only the cosmological observations, but at the other extreme of the scale, the local gravity tests such as the solar system Cassini-type constraints. That is very, very difficult to do, those two things. Now, first of all, one has to set some parameters to limit the kinds of modified gravity theories that we're able to actually characterize and discuss. And typically we make two assumptions, and of course you can violate one or both of these and find models which won't fit into what I'm talking about. But these are reasonable starting points, that you have a metric theory of gravity and that you have energy momentum conservation in the matter sector. You can violate both of those things, but I'm not going to discuss that. So what then are the key general requirements of such a modified gravity theory? So first of all, on small nonlinear scales, you will have to recover general relativity. In order to account for the solar system observations, you have to be extremely close to general relativity, because the solar system is Newtonian, and GR gives the Newtonian limit. And getting the Newtonian limit is not a trivial thing at all. Many modified gravity theories, an example was given by Mark, fail dismally on this point. On superhorizon scales, on the other extreme, because of energy momentum conservation, there's an approach to the curvature perturbation known as the separate universe approach, which basically says that on superhorizon scales, the curvature perturbation evolves as if it were in a Friedman universe, and different patches correspond to different Friedman universes. And apart from the technical details, what this means is that the perturbations on these scales have to evolve in a way which is strictly compatible with the background evolution. You can't deviate from that. So your model has to be constrained by that because of energy momentum conservation. And then in between these two extremes, we have the intermediate scales corresponding to structure formation at low redshift, which is our premier probe of acceleration. And this is where all the complication comes in, because the Poisson equation is modified when you modify the theory of gravity. And one of the problems we have is that we no longer have simulations to guide us. In-body simulations have to be redone completely, and that is a highly non-trivial task. So remember that GR has these two key features. It's got a spin 2 graviton, which is the only carrier of gravity. That was nicely explained by Mark. And also there is minimally coupled matter in the theory, which is also referred to, the importance of that was referred to also in Mark's talk. Modified gravity will change both of these features. Not just one or the other, they both have to be changed. So what about, let me just first discuss the background in a kind of schematic way. Suppose I'm putting the modification on the left-hand side just to emphasize that it's a modification of gravity, and I'm just calling it a dark, some functional parameter which carries the modification of GR in the Friedman equations. So the H squared equation and the H dot equation will have these modification terms, and on the right is just ordinary matter. There's no dark energy field. So the examples that I can give you for F of R theory, where the gravitational Lagrangian is F of R, the A dark factor has this fairly complicated form, which collapses to zero for GR. And in the DGP brain world model, A dark looks a lot simpler. It's just 1 over some constant, the crossover scale, times the Hubble rate. Those are just two examples. I'll repeatedly use these two examples of modified theories because they are the simplest examples that we have, not because I think they describe the real world. Now, if we look purely at the background, then we can constrain the background of any model by geometric tests, for example, the supernovae tests and the baryonacoustic oscillations. And then there's also weak lensing also puts constraints on the background, but these are the two premier probes of the background expansion history of any cosmological model. The problem we have, although we obviously need to apply these to any given model and to make sure that it has the right expansion history, the problem when we're trying to distinguish this from a general relativity model with dynamical dark energy is that we can't actually do that using geometric tests alone. In other words, we can always find a GR model that will mimic the modified gravity model. Because geometric tests all are based on this co-moving distance, the integral of 1 over h of z. So if we can just reproduce the h of z that we get from the modified theory, then we cannot use those geometric tests to say, ah, this is modified gravity. So if I just write down the GR version as a dark energy on the right-hand side of the Friedmann equation, and the modified gravity as the correction on the left-hand side, I can just define my dark energy field to be this term on the right-hand side, suitably normalized, then I'll get the same co-moving distance and the same equation of state. So I can't distinguish, I can't say, ah, the supernovae and the baryon acoustic oscillations tell me that this is a modified gravity model. And of course the reason I can't do that is because I'm only using a small amount of information. I have to bring in the growth of structure, because theories which will give me the same expansion history will necessarily give me different rates of growth of structure. And structure formation is suppressed by acceleration, but it's suppressed in different ways in these two options. In GR, it's suppressed because dark energy starts to dominate over the matter. And in modified gravity, it's suppressed because gravity starts to weaken. And although these effects can produce exactly the same H of Z, they will produce different suppression of the growth of structure. If we write down the equation for the overdensity of the matter, we can write it in this form always, where the effect of G is the factor which conveys the correction to GR. In GR, that's just equal to G itself as it's determined by local physics, but in modified gravity, it could be either greater than or less than G, or it could vary over time and with scale. I've got two examples here. In F of R, typically because of this extra scalar degree of freedom, enhances clustering, you get a greater amount of growth of structure than you would relative to the GR dynamical dark energy model. And the DGP goes the other way. It actually suppresses structure even more dramatically than lambda CDM does, or more dramatically than any dynamical dark energy model does. And so this degeneracy, where I could have the green and red curves on top of the black curves if I were plotting the Hubble expansion rate as a function of Z, it's broken if I can plot the evolution of the overdensity with redshift or scale factor. And here I show an example which uses a proposed 12,000 square degree survey. I can't remember which it was. It's shown by these very small red error bars here, but the idea in principle is the following. In the top plot, you can see the black curve is on top. The black curve consists of two models, the dark energy model and the modified gravity model. Lambda CDM is slightly different. And this is showing the expansion rate as a function of redshift, H as a function of redshift. We actually currently have these three points here. I think these two are from WMAP. Actually, all three of them are from WMAP. But suppose you have this mega galaxy survey of the future. It would have error bars, say, of this kind, and we could tie down the expansion history of any model by this data. It would have to be go through all these red points. But if we were able to measure the rate of growth of structure through this F factor here, which is d log delta by d log A, then the degeneracy would be broken, and in this case it's broken in favor, say, of general relativity. You could see that the modified gravity model would be ruled out because its rate of growth of structure is not in agreement with the data. Of course, this begs the question which was raised by Lecce in the last talk: how do we actually control the degeneracy induced by bias, the evolution of bias here? We could probably engineer some bias evolution which could mimic this difference here. And so that would be a problem to control. Well, the bias is how do we map the observed luminous matter in the galaxies to the underlying distribution of the dominant dark matter? And typically that's encoded in a constant bias parameter, which is then constrained by observations in the framework of the standard model, the lambda CDM model. But you have to actually impose this idea that bias is scale independent, and there's a constant ratio between the two power spectra that works over all scales. And it seems to work quite well in lambda CDM. But we have, because it's astrophysics that's involved, you know, how baryons fall into potential wells created by dark matter, that's nonlinear astrophysics. Nobody really knows how to deal with bias. And so all I'm saying is that it's theoretically conceivable that one could come up with more complicated models of bias which could actually account for that kind of difference. And so you wouldn't really be able to rule out the modified gravity because you might have enough bias, a complicated enough bias that could actually mimic that. I don't know how realistic that could be. I mean, people like Nietzsche would have to answer that, not me. And I'll just show a follow-up slide, which is actually this paper by Gutzo et al. That was discussed after Leach's talk this morning. This is using redshift distortions to add the original point from the 2DF, which was the growth function at the redshift of 0.2 or something from 2DF. There are two new points that have been added at a redshift of about 0.35 and 0.55 or something. By the VVDS and 2SLAC. 2SLAC is 2DS, sorry, 2DF, SDSS, and quasars. Yeah. Sorry, Nick is the expert. Yeah, he'll answer any questions too. I shouldn't have started off there, but 2SLAC, as you say. And VVDS, you told me earlier, but I've forgotten already. Right, okay. So that's the highest redshift point there. So we now have from this recent Nature paper an extra 2 points, because I didn't mention that we actually have very little observational handle on this function F, the overdensity at different redshifts. We now have 3 of these points, very big error bars as you can see. This is, by the way, is the Einstein de Sitter model. And here we have dark matter plus dark energy with coupling, a model of the form that Mark was discussing. The red one is lambda CDM, of course. The black error bars are as they would be, as they predicted to be with the space experiment. This is a dark energy experiment being proposed to the European Space Agency. This dotted one here is an open model that's ruled out, well, not ruled out, but severely disfavored by the data. And the black one is a DGP, I believe. The green one is another coupling model with constant coupling. So those just illustrate how different models of dark energy or of acceleration may be constrained. The existing data is obviously too much subject to uncertainty to really do anything like constraining or ruling out models. But future surveys will do much better than that. Now, if we move away from the actual tracking of the overdensity delta, this growth function F, we're looking really at low redshift tests of the evolution of structure, and they are essentially, well, the premier ones really are the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect and weak lensing. So Leach has already described these, but let me just quickly go over it again. This is the picture which was described in words by Leach of photons are moving from last scattering and they fall into potential wells created by the dark matter. But these potential wells are decaying, so the photons, the gain in energy and the loss in energy as they climb out are different, and so we have a net decrement or increment in the frequency depending on the model, which is detected in the CMB as the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. Weak lensing is also a very sensitive probe because it probes the dark matter distribution. This is an example of the dark matter distribution from another Nature paper not so long ago, which is probed by weak lensing, and so it gives us a handle on the amount of matter that we have and therefore a handle on the amount of dark energy or the strength of the acceleration in modified gravity. But there is a complication with weak lensing, and the complication is that we have to deal with the linear to nonlinear transition because we're dealing with structure that's already formed here. It's not as clean a probe as the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect in some ways. And the real complication when we're looking at modified gravity theories is that in GR, in the standard model, we can deal with this transition because we have n-body simulations to guide us. They guide us with phenomenological rules of thumb as to how to understand these dark matter halos. But we don't have those n-body simulations in modified gravity. So applying the weak lensing tests is more of a challenge. But I will now just quickly run through those two simple examples that I've used already up to now, the FFR and the DGP. The F of R has already been discussed by Mark. It's exactly the same model he discussed, so I can go through it rather quickly. The new light degree, scalar degree of freedom introduced by this nonlinear function of the Ricci scalar is able to accelerate the universe at low energies if we choose mu to be of the order of the Hubble rate. And so this successfully gives us late-time acceleration, but it's strongly, at the same time, this light scalar is responsible for a strong violation of solar system constraints. And all F of R models, not just this one, they all have this problem, because they all correspond to omega equals zero Brans-Dickey models plus potential. And the only way around that is to fine-tune the potential in such a way that you can actually have a chameleon-type effect, that the mass of the light degree of freedom increases near massive bodies like the Sun, and it goes off towards zero on cosmological scales. So you can actually get around this with a chameleon effect, but it looks a little bit, well, it looks extremely contrived, and certainly not very pretty as a theory. But it can be done. You can fix the theory, but at a great cost of economy and beauty. What about modified gravity from brain worlds? Well, here you have a richer set of possibilities. You can have new massive modes of the graviton, spin 2 modes, spin 1 modes, spin 0 modes. There are higher dimensional fields in the higher dimensional space-time, as well as gravity dilaton fields, form fields. They could have effects on our four-dimensional world, which could mimic acceleration. And it may be that these things could dominate at low energies. In fact, that is a bit of a problem, because typically in string theory, all of these things, all these corrections happen at high energies. To get them to happen at low energies is much more of a challenge. So the kind of possibilities we talk about, these bulk fields like the dilaton and the form fields, can drive acceleration on the brain. An example of that is the ekpyrotic model, or the cyclic set of models. They fall into that sort of broad class. But they're not of the type that I'm thinking of, because they don't modify gravity on large scales in the way that they just produce an effect of dark energy from a field in the bulk, which is essentially projected onto the brain. Or you could have that the gravitational field itself, the higher dimensional gravitational field, when we project it onto the brain, modifies GR at low energies. And that's what the DGP does, the DGP model. I should just point out that the people, Diwali, Gabadazi, and Parati, who constructed this model, first of all, they constructed it for a Minkowski four-dimensional world. They weren't interested in dark energy. They were interested in a new approach to the hierarchy problem. And then a cosmologist came along, and he realized, Cedric Defayette this is, he realized that if he applied this to a Friedman brain, it induced self-acceleration. So it does have this very appealing feature that wasn't constructed to fix the problem of acceleration. It actually predicted it in a sort of sense without actually trying. And this is how the Friedman equation is modified in the DGP. You have this minus H over RC term, and you can see that as rho tends to zero in the late universe, H tends to a constant, 1 over RC. So we get the sitter-type acceleration, a natural self-acceleration. The reason is that gravity is slowly leaking off the brain at late times, becoming weaker and weaker, and so the universe self-accelerates without any dark energy being needed. The brain is four-dimensional, and it's sitting in a five-dimensional bulk. Yeah, yes. If you want extra dimensions, they'd be compactified, and you'd have to deal with them. But they would have high energy effects, and they wouldn't mess this up at low energies. In this model, it's essentially five-dimensional. Or you just have to put it in by hand. I have to choose RC to be of the order of H naught inverse to get this to work. So again, you don't solve the coincidence problem. You just have a new approach to it. But it's got an appealing, this appealing aspect. There's no tension in the brain in this case, actually. This is actually a parameter which weights the two Einstein-Hilbert actions. You've got a five-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action from the bulk, and then a four-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action, which recovers GR at high energies. And the RC is the weighting factor between the two, which tells you which one dominates. And if you choose RC to be large, then the five-dimensional action dominates on large scales or low energies. And that's what we've got here. You have a regular solution as well. It's sort of the so-called normal branch. That doesn't self-accelerate. Actually, what that does is it gives you W less than minus 1 when you put dark energy on the brain. So it also has interesting features to it, the other branch. at high energies, when H is much bigger than this energy scale, 1 over RC, you can see quite easily that you recover GR. So your CMB and your early universe inflation, everything, at least from the background point of view, is safe. So this, yeah.
Well,
what happens there is if your brain, which is embedded in higher dimensions, say, is bent like this, and you've got a gravitational wave emitted here, it can reach that point on the brain in two ways, either along the brain or through the bulk. And the waves through the bulk get there before the waves along the brain. It doesn't happen in these models, no. So this looks like a very appealing way of getting self-acceleration without dark energy, even though you have to fine-tune it, at least it's one step forward. It's as simple as LCDN from the background point of view. There's one parameter, 1 over RC instead of lambda. But of course, life is never going to be that easy. This is really too good to be true. It took a few years for people to work this out because it's actually extremely complicated. It's not like a simple phantom ghost scalar field or... And it's even more complicated than some of the other known ghosts that you get in F of R mu nu type theories. But there is also a ghost in the gravitational sector here. It's a five-dimensional ghost. That's why it's been more difficult to track it down. So we have this ghost state in the scalar, the same scalar sector of the theory which is responsible for self-acceleration. We don't see it in the background. Everything looks fine in the background. But we have to accept the fact that when you perturb this brain world, when you put matter on the brain and you move it around and galaxies start growing, this ghost state threatens to turn the whole theory unstable. Now, it is still not known on what time scale the instability will operate. It's not known whether or not classically you can avoid this. You can safely use the DGP as a classical toy model and say that some ultraviolet completion will fix the problem. So that's still a bit of a controversial point, but essentially one would say that if you're applying the same severity that I used earlier to reject phantom scalar fields and quiescence, we'd have to throw out the DGP until somebody finds a way of fixing it. It's actually very subtle, because if we look at the Minkowski solution, there's no ghost. No ghost at all. But there's a VDV discontinuity. If I go to the Friedman brain, the VDV discontinuity disappears, and the ghost appears. And the ghost is extremely subtle. The ghost is either in the thing called the radion, which is the scalar mode of the five of the bend of the. It's called the brain bending mode. It's a scalar mode due to the bending of the brain by the presence of matter. Either that's a ghost, or when that is regular, the spin zero, the helicity zero part of the graviton is a ghost. When the helicity zero part of the graviton is regular, the radion is a ghost. So you can't escape this ghost. It's very subtle. It's not easy to explain in simple terms why it appears. But it seems to be that self-acceleration is associated with ghosts in these kinds of theories.
Phantom models, you sort of have this phantom field, and you have to choose what parameter to put up on that.
Yeah.
You might have to put it ridiculously low in order to have this phantom behavior appearing sort of above the cutoff here. Whereas, if I understand at least what Vali says about these models, here you don't have that choice. Here, the phantom behavior appears precisely in this wrong cutoff. So you sort of
Diwali actually claims that this ghost is not a problem because there's another problem with DGP, is a strong coupling problem, which is more controllable. You can sort of see perhaps how UV completion deals with it. I think his claim is that because of the strong coupling problem, this perturbative analysis is unreliable. But people like Koyama and others have done other analyses which show to second order that the ghost is still there. So I think it's controversial. I suppose nobody really knows the final word on this. It may be that there's a way of rescuing the DGP, but people are trying to construct generalizations of DGP to get around this ghost problem, simply because it is such an appealing possibility.
The case,
I don't think anyone's looked at that. People are currently looking at six-dimensional models with intersecting brains and conical singularities and all sorts of other possibilities. But that's very, very complicated. Unlike this model, the background becomes much more complicated.
So, if in fact in the early universe it's agreement with the relativities, that means that structure formation is no problem?
Well, the CMB would be no problem. The structure formation is a bit different because that's you're then talking about low redshifts. And I showed you that that plot earlier, just as an example. Sorry, PowerPoint's extremely slow. You can see there really is very strong suppression here. And in fact, this is indicative of a strong integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. You might have problems if you normalize the power spectrum so as to fit this kind of delta over A to the matter power spectrum. You're probably going to find that the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect is beyond observational limits. I think that's actually what has more or less been found. It does affect structure formation and it affects it too strongly. That's right. So the F of R is also had the problems that Mark was talking about. I think the DGP has its own version of that problem. So it isn't just the ghost. I mean, that might have been a bit misleading. Even if we fix the ghost, there are other things that would have to be addressed. So the conclusion from those two examples, and this is borne out by other variations on these examples, is that in fact the simplest things you can think of for modified gravity don't work. So these are the simplest models in their class. F of R is the simplest scalar tensor model that's out there. And DGP is certainly the simplest higher dimensional brain world model with infrared corrections to GR that we know of. Both of them are failing because the scalar degree of freedom that's there by construction to get late time acceleration. We can fix the F of R by a chameleon mechanism. We may be able to fix the DGP by various probably equally contrived and ugly looking corrections. But the point is that in order to get a theoretically consistent and observationally viable model for modified gravity, we have to do a lot more work than we may have thought of before. So either we're forced to a conclusion, which I'm sure many people have a prejudice towards, that GR is correct on large scales. It's very, very difficult to modify. Or modified gravity is going to turn out to be a lot more complicated than we thought. I suppose there's a third option, that we're all just looking in the wrong place. And somewhere out there is a simple modified gravity model that nobody's thought of yet. That is possible. So theorists are engaged in this task to try and find ghost-free generalized DGP-type models, or to find generalizations of the F of R which are not too complicated nor too contrived and ugly, or to find some new modified gravity model which can pass the kind of tests that these two models have failed on. And from a phenomenology point of view, in parallel with the theoretical attempts, we need to actually start looking, since we have no favored modified gravity model, but we can't close the book on the issue yet, we have no proof that there isn't one, we're driven to the question as to, can we develop model-independent tests for the failure of general relativity? So it's a little bit of a shift of emphasis. Once you start hunting for various options for modified gravity, you start seeing that there are none that look in any way favored, you're then driven to the conclusion that perhaps you have to focus on model-independent tests for the failure of GR, because that in itself would be a major milestone, even if we didn't know what the modification was. If we knew that to some level of statistical significance there is a breakdown in GR, then that in itself would be a major step forward. And if we knew to some statistical level of significance that there's no breakdown from it, what we could see, that would also be a significant thing for us to understand. So I'll end off then, sorry I'm going over time a bit, I'll end off just by trying to indicate what these model-independent approaches might indicate to us, or how they might evolve in principle. The scalar perturbations in the metric can be described by these two potentials, the Newtonian potential psi, which determines how particles are accelerated, and the curvature potential phi, which gives you the perturbation of the curvature of the constant time surfaces. So the Poisson equation for structure formation has this form here in a modified gravity theory where G effective carries the modification to GR. The Euler equation is of this form, where theta m is the matter velocity, psi is this potential here. And then there's a stress constraint in GR. The sum of these two potentials is zero. But in modified gravity, there's a dark gravity anisotropic stress. It's like the anisotropic stress in photons, except it's gravitational. It's not associated with a fluid. So GR has this zero and G effective equal to G, but modified gravity has both of these non-zero. So, for example, in DGP, I've already mentioned G effective is bigger than G and sigma dark is proportional to delta itself, the overdensity. Whereas in F of R models, G effective is less than G and sigma dark is proportional to the second derivative over the first derivative of F. Those are just for those two simple examples. So when we test for modified gravity, in principle, this is how it could work. The total density perturbation from the Poisson equation gives me phi divided by G effective. Galaxy velocities will give me the psi potential. Lensing gives me phi minus psi because the deflection angle is the gradient of this phi minus psi. So weak lensing gives me the difference. Then from these three equations, I've got phi plus psi, which then determines the dark anisotropic stress. And so in principle, I can determine all these things from observations. In practice, of course, it's much more difficult to do all these things, but in principle. And on this basis, Song and Koyama have developed this very neat consistency test for GR versus modified gravity. This combination of the potentials, the velocities, and the overdensity must be 1 in GR and deviates from 1 in all modified gravity theories. Now, of course, this raises the question of, you know, just to what level of statistical significance would you be able to conclude that consistency relation is broken. But this is at least an in-principle test. It's the only one I know of which is completely model-independent. And I should end off, I was going to show you how coupled dark energy models introduce a complication here and a way around that, but I'll leave that and just skip to the conclusions. Well, some conclusions. There's no conclusion to the story, unfortunately, and you already know that from the previous talks. What can we say? Well, first of all, observations do imply acceleration. I wouldn't say that was 100%. Nothing's 100% in physics, but it seems to be extremely compelling, and the evidence just seems to get stronger and stronger. So we'll accept it. It's very definitely the case that this was not predicted by theory, and that was explained nicely by Leecher this morning by comparison with some other examples. And of course, it's also clear from everything we've said and others have said before that theory cannot explain it. When we look at the dynamical dark energy alternatives in GR, there is no natural model at all. There are lots of candidates, but nothing looks natural or compelling. When we try to modify GR and we've crossed the hurdles of theoretical consistency, we find that even forgetting about observations, there's no natural model that arises from theory, and the ones that we can come up with either fail at the first or second or third hurdle, or when we manage to scrape them through all the various tests, they look so ugly from the various corrections and epicyclic add-ons that one really has to think that they can't be the true theory of gravity. And a point I'd like to make here is that it's clear from this, and should have been clear anyway before that because of the nature of physics, that observations can't find theories for us. We can't use cosmological observations to find a model of dark energy or of acceleration. You cannot find a theory via observations. It just doesn't work that way. The problem we have is that we have too many theories here. We have so many candidate theories that can, in principle, explain this acceleration that it's literally impossible to chase them all down with the observations. It's not trivial to test a model properly with the observations to the point where you can constrain it and or rule it out. And it's just impossible to test all of those candidates. As soon as you rule one out, another 10 are invented by clever theorists the next day. And so this really moves us to another point that we have to actually go down the road of model-independent approaches as far as possible. What are the key questions that we have to tackle? Well, I think Abe posed question number one in a nice form this morning. You know, is it lambda or is it dynamical? I think that is the key question. number one. And then the sub-question that follows from that is, if it's not lambda, then it's either GR with dynamical dark energy or it's modified gravity. And I've tried to show very briefly how one can distinguish between these two possibilities. So in principle, if we use the expansion history and the structure formation in the model, we can actually answer both of these questions in parallel, in a way. I'm not suggesting they go on sequentially. Some people look at that one and some people look at this one. Of course, if we find that there's modified gravity, then we've answered question one anyway. But when I say in principle here, we are still quite a long way from the kind of observational sensitivity that we need to really distinguish these two. It really is very much an in-principle test at the moment. And my final point, and I think this is an important point which cropped up earlier, and that is the fact that even if we haven't found success so far, one thing we can say is that looking at all of these options, these alternatives, and trying to answer all of these big questions unsuccessfully, we can conclude that we actually understand GR and gravity a lot better than we did before. Even if we don't understand dark energy and acceleration, we do actually understand aspects of GR and aspects of gravity better than we did before. So all is not lost, even if we haven't found the answer to the big questions yet. So am I. I mean, that is just one F of our model. It was motivated by the simple idea that, can I find an action F of R which doesn't have Minkowski space as a low energy limit? And the easiest way to do that is 1 over R, because R can't go to 0. And it just turned out that it does actually do what you want, but it does it at too high a price. There are more sophisticated F of R's which will get around all the various problems, but none of them is any better motivated theoretically. They're all constructed to fit the problem, if you like, and that's really the point I'm making here. That there's no natural model coming from theory. Absolutely none at all. There's no guidance from theory, and partly it's because it's low energy. Because it's ultraviolet. If it were ultraviolet, if we're saying, okay, how do we modify GR in the ultraviolet? Well, string theory tells us this. Loop quantum gravity tells us that. Not only do they tell us immediately what we can try to look for, it's also true that those corrections don't suffer from the same kind of pitfalls, and they're not subject to solar system constraints. So because it's early universe, you can do anything you like, really. We don't know what happened in the early universe. We don't have something like the solar system to trip us up. But also they don't have the same, you know, the presence of ghosts and so on can occur in high energy corrections, but not to the same degree. I think the theoretical consistency is easier to achieve in the ultraviolet corrected version of theories than the infrared. I don't know why. There seems to be some strange problem with infrared corrections to gravity, which I don't have a good understanding of. Yes. Well, I suppose all the. As Mark pointed out, the Cassini timing experiments are the most stringent. The binary pulsars, they... To some extent, the answer to your question is, I think people haven't really looked closely enough at what modified gravity theories would predict for binary pulsars. Not only the old Hulse-Taylor one, but the sort of stronger gravity type of pulse. Partly because people wouldn't know how to compute these things. You know, what kind of quadrupole formula are you going to use? And there's also going to be scalar gravitational radiation in modified gravity theories. So it may be that you know, an F of R model that manages to pass Cassini timing constraints, solar system constraints, will fail in a stronger gravity regime of the binary pulsar.
Yeah, but the unstable pulsar, right? I don't think it's constrained. You won't get scalar gravity
because it's not sort of the same mass. But I guess... Yes. I don't know. I mean, I think people like Damour and Gilles Esposito have looked at a class of scalar tensor theories and how they're constrained by binary pulsars. They've got a two-dimensional parameter space, which I vaguely remember, and some, you know, the binary pulsars constrain you somewhere in the horizontal and the timing in the vertical, but I don't know the details. But that's just for general scalar tensor theories, not looking at acceleration. Well, that's a very good question. Somebody has. Wayne Hu has done a PPN analysis. So he's really the pioneer of this idea, and it's just been taken a step further, I think. Well, no, if we look purely at scalar perturbations, regardless of the theory of gravity, as long as it's a metric theory of gravity, that's the most general scalar perturbation. I can always find a gauge, that's the Newtonian gauge. I can find a gauge in which the perturbed metric looks like that, and that's the most general. Oh, if I do that, then I've got to add in 2 degrees of freedom for the vectors and 2 degrees of freedom, well, for the GR tensors, you know, the spin 2 graviton. Well, actually, at the metric level, yes, another 2 degrees of freedom for vectors, another 2 degrees of freedom for tensors. But if you look at vector and tensor perturbations, we're not really addressing the question of how structure formation is affected. So although it's interesting and necessary to do that, partly just to look at whether there are any instabilities in those sectors, it's not directly relevant to using structure formation to discriminate these models from GR, because that involves just the scalars. Yeah.
And the question about PPN is sort of, in a sense, what you're trying to do with that sort of measure is something complementary. PPN would work really well in solar system, and people would know about that. You'd also like to come up with something with the same spirit as PPN that applies to the cosmological scale. That's what you're trying to do. So it's a different scale.
But you can do it. And also the scalar vector and tensor decouple on a cosmological background, which they wouldn't do in the solar system. Yes, but I suppose maybe I didn't make it clear enough that this could be applied independent of any modified gravity model to test for whether GR breaks down on large scales or not.
Right, but at the moment, I mean, so it's very nice to have something like that.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, as you said, I mean, you know, that's really difficult to know.
Sure.
Exactly what our observation is.
Yes, I could move the 1 to the left and subtract it and then have 0, but it's the same point. You know, is something 0 or not 0?
And so the question is really whether there is, if we can say that mu really has to be much bigger than 1 or something, which from other texts, that from other requirements. Mm. The other requirements might be that, well, we don't want a cosmology of constants, and there should be a natural explanation for acceleration, or we want to supplement this with the solar system. So that's it. It's possible to combine.
I don't think so. I mean, it would be nice to, but it's difficult enough to get to a point where we could say, if I combine all the observational variables as I've listed them here in terms of, you know, how you relate these to the observations, combine all those observations in this way and then test GR using that quantity. I think to hope that you could go further than that is quite ambitious. So it might be possible, but Yes. That's right. I suppose there's bimetric theories which are not metric in the simple way that I've explained. Mark probably knows more about this than I do, no? What else? Violating the energy conservation equation, that happens quite easily in lots of brain world models where you have energy exchange between the four-dimensional brain and the bulk. So it's easy to do that, but then it's not very well motivated. It's very phenomenologically, you can put it in by hand.
I guess I'm not sure whether to refer to the causal set of questions. I think prediction is perhaps a false strong word, but indications in causal sense that cosmological constants should fluctuate on a scale and time scale that is above the Hubble scale. Therefore, if you make some assumptions, you might expect a small level of capacity. I guess that's, as you said, a sort of effective thing. I think there are a lot of assumptions.
Yeah.
It's an example of a theory that people find.
I would assume that the low energy limit must be a metric theory of causal sets.
Yes, it is, but I guess I'm saying that the process that is linked to the dark energy type theory comes from that case given
story. Thank you. I'm not sure how one would fit gauge theories into this, you know, sort of Einstein-Cartan type theories. They're not strictly metric in the way I've... So they wouldn't fall into my class of... or this class of modified gravity. Perhaps that's the most immediate way to violate it. Tevez's scalar vector tensor theory, and in fact, just coming back to the previous question about the vector sector there can become acausal if you don't restrict the parameters. So looking at the vector perturbations there is actually quite important to get the range of physical parameters right. Now, the Tevez models can actually appear. Well, there's a claim that they can fit the CMB and the large-scale structure and the supernova data. I haven't looked at them myself, so I'm not sure how solid that claim is, but certainly there are papers out there claiming that you can do that. Whether you can... because Tevez introduces another... on top of the scalar, introduces a vector degree of freedom, it's sort of uglier than a scalar tensor theory, and so it's not going to be any use to us unless it simultaneously gets rid of dark matter. So if you had a scalar vector tensor theory that didn't need dark matter and didn't need dark energy, then that would be interesting. But as far as I know, it's not able to do that. I'm not sure.
But if I was less ambitious,
would
it
seem
that there's no problems in the solar system?
Well, there's the recent paper by Ruth Durrer and others... and Pedro Ferreira claiming that solar system observations are okay, at least for a class of these models.
Solar system observations are okay?
Well, it seems to be that they're all okay, but they've shown that the Tevez model reduces to an Einstein ether model, so it's a vector tensor model. So it's slightly simpler, but it's still more complicated than scalar tensor. So even if it does the trick, we can get scalar tensor theories which fit all the data as well. It's like taking an f of r model, which has one arbitrary function. We add another arbitrary function, then we can fit anything we like. But then we just that's why I didn't discuss general scalar tensor models, because they can do the trick, but they're kind of cheating. There's too much arbitrariness in this, in them.
So the statement is that if you add one more scalar tensor or a vector,
yeah, you've got enough freedom. It seems. I mean, I don't know that everything has been checked. I don't know if all the binary pulsar issues and every single observational test has been exhaustively explored. But the sort of the big ticks have been, at least the claim is that these models pass the big tests, the obvious ones.
Including the structure formation, the four-day functions that we are plotting.
Not as far as I know. I mean, the data is not yet constraining enough. Perhaps, you know, and maybe in the future a lot of things are going to be ruled out by better and better data, and this is what we're hoping for. But currently, no, they can pass those hurdles, apparently.
You mentioned the n-body simulation. There have been a couple of, I guess, partial attempts at this today. Mm-hmm. There's this work by Stavin on Jane.
Yes. Oh, right. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. The DGP model has a horribly nonlinear Poisson equation. And Jane himself is saying he didn't know how to simulate that one.
Yeah, this wasn't quite.
I think f of r is a bit better. Less worse.
Are we immediately led to a big correction? We've got two constraints, right? We want to solve explained acceleration. Therefore, my coefficients have to be something. If I do that, is the strength that Poisson equation has to be?
Well, the Poisson equation is essentially governing the sort of linear to semi-nonlinear regime. And the sort of solar system is a sort of more nonlinear regime. So In the intermediate scale, this is where the scalar degree of freedom is at its strongest in a way. Well, not its strongest, where it's really making itself felt. And it is modifying the Poisson equation. I don't know exactly how this modification operates in f of r, depending on f, obviously.
People have tried to try to do some generic things where they set measures.
Yes. What kind of singularities? Well, I suppose a successful modified gravity theory would recover GR at high energies. So the Big Bang type singularities, and presumably by the same token, black hole singularities would look the same as in GR. Although, having said that, what I'm really saying is that in order to recover GR and solar system scales, I expect that you'll recover the standard features of black hole collapse. But I'm not sure that in a strongly non-linear regime, the scalar field might start doing things that it doesn't do in the solar system. So I shouldn't make too bold a claim about that. I mean, if I have a phantom scalar field around,
they get
eaten up. Yeah.
Well, the true answer is vacuum depends on how much stuff you care about what happens.
I think it was only one, actually. So this was just the point that I have left out of the dark energy models coupled dark energy. And the complications that coupled dark energy introduces can be seen by realizing the following, that in modified gravity, all the matter fields feel the modified gravity equally. So you don't violate the equivalence principle. You change it from GR, but you don't violate it. All fields, baryons, radiation, dark matter. In coupled dark energy, where we have only dark sector coupling, the CDM breaks the equivalence principle because it's being dragged by the dark energy. The baryons don't feel this coupling. And so the coupled dark energy can be distinguished from modified gravity by realizing that the Euler equation is broken in the dark matter sector, but not in the baryon sector. So for baryons, the velocity is related to the potential in this standard form, but in CDM, you're going to get a correction term, which I've just schematically put in by a correction factor mu here, which arises from the coupling between CDM and the dark energy. And when we measure velocities, we can only measure them from the luminous galaxies. And so the velocity that we think we're measuring and the overdensity that we are measuring, the total overdensity, because we've got lensing and other probes of the total density, they do not fit the standard equation, which I think is something like d delta by dt plus theta over a is zero. So we can independently measure the velocity and the density, but we can only measure the baryon velocity. And here we got the total density. So in the uncoupled case, we can measure these two things, and we find when we add them like this, we get zero in principle. But in a coupled model, because the dark matter velocity is violating the Euler equation, this will be violated. This will be non-zero. So in principle, by measuring peculiar velocities, we can distinguish coupled dark energy from modified gravity. Well, this is the claim. This is work which is going on at the moment. And this is what it looks like to us.
Right on.